Hello and welcome to The Cutaneous Connection, a podcast from the staff at Dermatology Times aiming to provide you with the latest news in dermatology, from exclusive interviews with leading experts to a glimpse at what goes on behind the scenes of research and innovation. I'm your host, Lauren Buchanan. In today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Nanette Silverberg, who recently led the annual Revolutionizing Vitiligo virtual conference. She took a deep dive into the importance of early intervention and gave an overview of topical care for patients of all ages.
Oh, okay. I'm Dr. Nanette Silverberg. I am part of the Department of Dermatology Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. And then I have two sets of titles. I'm a clinical professor of dermatology and pediatrics and chief of pediatric dermatology for Mount Sinai Health Systems. It's very exciting to have a meeting dedicated to vitiligo. I think that we need to have more meetings dedicated to vitiligo over time. And it's important because vitiligo is really coming of age now. So, I mean, right now we have three products, you know, that are FDA approved for vitiligo. So we have the topical ruxolitinib, which was approved last year for 12 and over. But we also have the new Avita device that was approved for grafting of vitiligo. So MKTP, melanocyte keratinocyte transfer grafting. And we have also we have ultraviolet light sources like the 308 nanometer laser. So over time we're building, and I think when you hear, you know, from the meeting, within the meeting, you will have heard a lot of discussion of pipeline. And my thing is I really push for people to go in for early intervention. And one of the reasons I really encourage people to do it is that you see surveys, and there was this survey that was published just this year, looking at patients and practitioners. And on average, there's like a more than a 2-year wait until people get treatment. They're still almost half of doctors are just turning people away and not offering treatment. And it's a lost opportunity, because the disease really, once you get the disease and you leave it and it goes into its chronic phase, it's really hard to control. And of course, you know, I think as time goes by, we're going to have our FDA approved JAK inhibitors and biologic medicines for vitiligo that will control the extended phase. But there's still this early phase in vitiligo that we think people may be able to achieve cure and clearance quickly. It's my personal belief that some of those cures, because I've seen kids, you know, over past two decades that treated, you know, originally cleared and stayed clear 20 years later. So I do think that people can at least have very sustained clearance, if not necessarily, I don't know about lifetime, we'll have to see about that. But I do think, you know, getting in there right away and hitting it and clearing it as fast as you can makes for best outcomes.
Delving deep into your early intervention session, you know, you mentioned the importance of getting in, given the disease state at the very beginning. But what are some additional pearls, takeaways, best practices, especially for those providers who may be in a place or with arguing with an insurance company on whether this is cosmetic or a necessity?
Well, you obviously have been speaking to the right people, because it really is a very, very tremendous problem that we experience. And it has been from the beginning when we first started with, in 2002, when tacrolimus was coming out, and, you know, we started to see good results, and we were trying to give it to patients. We're just getting a lot of rejections. And even, all these years later, now the insurers are thinking maybe they should have covered it, and they don't want to cover ruxolitinib, but ruxolitinib's the FDA-approved product, so that it, you know, if you are in that age group and you do qualify, I think it's important for physicians to, first of all, most of our patients have tried other stuff by the time they hit the dermatologist, so it's something that I encourage primary care doctors to go ahead and prescribe something when a patient comes through the office, because anything you prescribe has an anti-inflammatory effect and may control disease. So you don't have to give, if you're not comfortable giving clobetasol or class one topical steroid, but you can give a mid-potency product and at least address some inflammation until they can get a patient can get to a dermatologist. So we want primary cares to intervene as quickly as possible. And if they understand the, you know, usage pattern for Opzelura, I think that they can absolutely prescribe that. You know, it's really the burden on the dermatologist to educate patients and to treat properly. So the treatments that we are, the way that we do it is, first of all, we indicate location. I think it's really important to demonstrate facial location, because we can to document any distress the patient is experiencing. You know, at least half of our patients have some kind of emotional distress, and as you hit, like when you go from early childhood up to into adolescence and into adulthood, you approach almost 100% of patients experience some kind of distress from vitiligo. And of course, those can lead to long-term diseases such as anxiety and depression. It can trigger extended phases of psychological distress. So we really want our patient, we want to document it. Patient is unhappy, high noticeability, you know, those are things we can document. But ultimately, the drugs have a certain, particularly ruxolitinib, has a certain FDA approval pattern. So 12 years of age and older. So we're picking a certain age group. Non-segmental vitiligo. So I mark the type of vitiligo that is non-segmental. And then I mark the body surface area that they're going to treat. And it's supposed to be less than 10% body surface area. And we have patients who come in with 20 or 30%. And I'll give them something else for certain areas. And then we'll focus on the areas that we know get a really rapid response to topical ruxolitinib. Like when you look at the studies, the facial VASI, the F-VASI is responds much faster than the total VASI. So we often go in, treat the face, you know, treat the head and neck, and then, you know, and then certain areas, and then we'll move on to other areas. The head and neck's only about 3%, 3 to 5% body surface area. So we still can really go in and treat the areas that bother the patients the most. And so I kind of, I make it clear how we're using it, that we're using it on label. We certainly do prior authorizations, and we always mark what the patient failed. And I think that's important also to mark what the patient failed. Ultimately, you know, through the years, and particularly when we were prescribing, initially when we started to prescribe narrowband UVB, when we were prescribing the first rounds of laser, at that point, and home units, we always have a letter that states that vitiligo is not cosmetic. It's a systemic inflammation with psychological consequences for patients who are not treated, and that the untreated inflammation can trigger other forms of autoimmunity. And you know, but there's still people who don't get these drugs, and it's really unfortunate that we still have this situation where patients don't get innovation. It is cost saving, but is it really cost saving? If you could give somebody a tube of ruxolitinib when they were 12 and their disease just started, and you might clear them, is it better to leave them to depigment and to end up on psych meds and therapy and down the line, maybe, you know, multiple autoimmune conditions that were undiagnosed, or, I mean, to leave people and just say, oh, it's cosmetic and not, and like throw them out of the healthcare system is not reasonable. And it is a net, it probably costs more in the end if you project what the course of disease is and the kind of distress people experience, even just opportunity loss, you know, treating now, you know, if you can treat with a topical therapy, and we get really nice results with topical ruxolitinib, not necessarily with other things, just as a monotherapy. So you saved on phototherapy, you didn't necessarily, I mean, you know, we do have some patients, we combine it. It's not necessarily encouraged in the label, but, you know, sometimes we do combine, but as a monotherapy alone, it's quite effective. You can hand somebody a tube and they can treat their disease alone. They're not necessarily coming into the office for phototherapy or eczema or laser. They can, you know, particularly in certain situations, you might want to as well. But ultimately, it's actually probably very cost-saving, because if people have to go through, you know, prior to that, we might say a patient who was getting, we might give them a patient a tube of tacrolimus and then put them into phototherapy twice a week or three times a week. And that, you know, the insurance would pay $70 to $100, so it'd be $200 plus a week, $10,000, you know, versus a tube that probably lasts the patient most of the year. Maybe you know, it's really very cost effective in reality. And over time, I think we're going to see the that you know, effective treatment in vitiligo is very cost effective. And that's something that I think insurance companies don't perceive, because they only see the short term, the bottom line today, and the, you know, the balance sheet for this year, but they're not seeing the extended balance sheet on the healthcare system.
Thank you for sharing that perspective. And then let's go ahead and delve into the key takeaways from your other session on current topical recommendations for various age groups.
If you look at studies, where patients receive drug earlier versus later, there really was a notable improvement in outcomes when patients got topical medications or systemic medications faster. And also there's secondary component that there may be some benefit in patients in general to adding in narrowband UVB and vitamin D in early phases to kind of control the whole autoimmune process and the disease spread. So there are multiple things that we do. It's not just the topicals. I didn't want to just say topicals because, you know, I mean, obviously I don't want to only speak about ruxolitinib. They're really, it really is everything. Everything that you use works better if you get in earlier. Okay, so I'm sorry, that's the other. So I've been working with a group, and we have sponsored research from PDRA, which is the Pediatric Dermatology Research Alliance, to develop guidelines for pediatric vitiligo in the US. And it is a process. It's really, so we have a three-phase process. We just completed our topical therapy process, and that's it's still in submission. So I'm hopeful we're almost there in one of the better journals. So but not yet, but hopefully before your article comes out. It's really exciting. We got really an incredible cast of individuals who are just very dedicated to vitiligo. The vitiligo specialists like Pearl Grimes and Simal Desai, and vitiligo researchers like Victor Wong and David Rosmarin, and Dr. Amy Paller, who spoke at the meeting, and Dr. Leslie Castellasocio, and Dr. Dr. Larry Eichenfeld, and then we have individuals who are joining, who recently joined, and of course Dr. Coletta Azadon, who also spoke, who's really he's just a powerhouse in vitiligo. He publishes a lot. He's a very critical thinker, and so we put together the topical guidelines, and I think one of our they are sort of so we have the topical guidelines, and we started the process before ruxolitinib was FDA approved. So we had to go back and revise a little bit when it got approved. But in general, the idea is that basically all the topical therapies work, but we have the options really to treat patients with a truly FDA approved product for vitiligo if they're over the age of 12, if they're 12 or older, I should say, and they have non-segmental disease. At the meeting, we presented some case series of kids who had also had, some of whom had segmental disease, who did well with the drug when it was instituted early. So we're seeing some really nice results, but the guidelines essentially are our usage guidelines, practical usage guidelines that suggest that really all the three major classes of drugs, including the topical JAK inhibitors, with topical ruxolitinib leading the way. And of course, we don't have the data for under 12, but we're starting to see some emerging data for atopic derm in kids 2 to 11. So I think that that data will help pave the way to our getting approval for kids with vitiligo. But I do think that you know, that may be our we may have to amend the guidelines soon. It would be nice, based on clinical trials that are starting. But we also have the older classes of drugs, the topical corticosteroids, you know, with the caveat of we have concerns that they may cause atrophy or glaucoma. So we're a little bit cautious about usage around the eye, particularly for an extended time period. And in intertriginous areas where you might get stretch marks. And of course, for that particular reason, part of our recommendations included bridging, you know, if we're using topical steroids, bridging on to a non-steroidal afterwards to limit the risk of atrophy. And of course, the non-steroidals, the older ones were topical calcineurin inhibitors like tacrolimus and pimecrolimus, both of which have data. And interestingly, there's even data published on usage for even under the age of 2, although neither of them are FDA approved for that indication. So we don't have the FDA approval. We do have like years, you know, 20 years of usage data. But you know, it's unfortunate that we didn't get approval years ago, because more people would have accessed the drugs, I do think. And it probably would have advanced vitiligo faster if we had had clinical trials in place at that point. But que sera, hindsight's 2020, right? and then, of course, in our guidelines, we think about optimizing therapy and so starting as soon as you can, and, you know, making sure you have the right diagnosis. We have a specific diagnostic definition we came up with. So making sure you have the right diagnosis, and part of our definition includes the fact that if left untreated, you can have really extensive disease or spread over time. So, you know, part of our concerns are to intervene when you need to. And some of those situations for us include thinking about risk factors for disease spreading, which include confetti lesions and halo nevi and trichrome vitiligo. And Kepner phenomenon. So those four are the signs of risk of spread. And so we're a little bit more aggressive with those kids. And we certainly consider adjunctive phototherapy. And we think that, considering it early on and moving in and treating and getting the best effect that you can so that you don't leave people on treatment forever, but that you treat them effectively, quickly, and you allow them to move on with their lives, repigment and move on with their lives. So I think ultimately we hear all these stories as vitiligo practitioners. We hear so many stories about people who went to a doctor and the person said to them, "Oh, it's nothing, leave it alone," and they didn't treat. Or they said, "Oh, there's nothing to do, let it go." And then, a person watches it and they have the stress, stress that they're, that their disease is spreading all the time. And it's really unfortunate, but it could also be partially because originally we didn't have good treatments, but for the past 20 years, we have had legitimately reasonable treatments. And there was really no reason not to treat. We really are pushing to have guidelines out and to educate people that vitiligo is treatable. It's treatable in kids. It might be even more treatable. If you really look at the data, kids respond faster, better, more completely when you use medications. And that's been true for tacrolimus, and it was true for clobetasol, and it's true and it's probably going to be true as we go along with our with ruxolitinib treatment. So I think that it is important for us to stop and say we have treatment. We don't cure everybody. There are certain areas if we have difficulty clearing, we're going to have trouble with palms and soles. We have trouble with fingertips because there are no hairs there. But areas like the face where we have a high density of hairs, although they're, vellus hairs, you don't necessarily see them, but they are there to donate pigment in the repigmentation process. And we are very fortunate in that way that we have that vitiligo, and especially the portions that really bother patients like the head and neck, which are so associated with stigma and are probably the most stressful to patients when you ask them and then you look at surveys, we really have the ability to reverse those areas on the head and neck that are really stressful to patients. So I think that it really is worthwhile to treat, and we hope that physicians will take the time to give out a prescription and take a chance on treatment. And I think they'll be pleasantly surprised with the options we have today.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Silverberg. And as always, for more Dermatology Times content, from articles to videos and more podcasts, visit www.dermatologytimes.com.